I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today, we're talking about the case of Chris Benoit, a much-loved wrestler who ended in a case of family annihilation. But the story isn't quite as simple as that. So I'm a little bit nervous about doing this case as well, because I know that this isn't just about covering crime. This is also covering an area which involves wrestling, and people who love wrestling know so much about it. So I hope that I do the facts proud in this case. So who was Chris Benoit? Well, I suppose we go back to his childhood and we can kind of see the connection with wrestling begins there. He was a massive fan of wrestling in his childhood. In particular, he idolised British wrestler Tom Dynamite Kid Billington and Bret Hart. Now, Hart is a member of the Hart wrestling family and they were huge. Benoit would actually go on to adopt a similar wrestling style that Hart had, even using his signature finishing move, the sharp shooter, which he was very well known for. And Chris Benoit also trained and was tutored by former wrestler Stu Hart. And it was said that he honed his wrestling skills in the Hart family dungeon. It was actually in the basement of the Hart family home. And that's one of the most notable wrestling schools in the world. He trained alongside people who became huge, but he trained alongside fellow Canadians and professional wrestlers Owen and Bret Hart. Now, Harts are a big wrestling family. Anybody who knows anything about wrestling knows that connection. They are well known in the wrestling world. There is some tragedy as well in this, because Owen Hart, well, he actually was killed really tragically in a wrestling match in 1999. There was sadly this equipment malfunction, and that meant that he ended up falling 78 feet. So basically, he was preparing to make this stunt entrance from the arena rafters. I'm sure a lot of you who watch wrestling or have even caught sight of it see that there's a huge amount of showmanship, and the way that people make entrances is often huge, and that's exactly what he was doing. Unfortunately, he fell and he hit the ropes of the wrestling ring, and it was so severe, the impact, that it severed his aorta. So that meant that his lungs filled with blood and he was dead within minutes. But you can imagine how horrific that was. Now, Benoit himself, well, he also adopted a very, what you would say is a high risk, high impact, very physical style of wrestling. So it was a very aggressive style of wrestling. And he was really well accomplished. He's an incredibly technical wrestler. He took it incredibly seriously, and his skills were second to none. He was somebody who was fully committed to both the athleticism and also the showmanship and the delivery of the match, the things that played out in the ring, so to speak. And one of the things that people noted about him was that he learned to adopt some of Billington's quite risky moves. And one of these included the flying headbutt, which instantly, when you come from my world of therapy and you know about the impact of head injury, you do get a few shivers down your spine, because the brain is something that we need to protect at all costs, primarily because it is what serves the purpose of keeping us fully able to be present in our daily life and also to be able to utilize our body in the best way possible. Brain is powerfully important. We all know that, but when I hear flying headbutt, I can imagine the impact and trauma that could potentially cause. So what this would involve was that he would jump from the top rope and then he would land on the opponent with his head. Now, he was massively skilled. He was really excellent at what he did, and he was hugely devoted to wrestling, and he wanted to give the crowd the best trip out. And because of this, he was hugely popular. Look him up, because one of the things that I'm going to talk about today is his erasure from a world that he inhabited and was a star in. And so because of his ability to take this very, very seriously and the fact that he did put on a great show, people genuinely respected him. Wrestling fans considered him a real contender in that world. This athleticism, this sheer technical ability that he proved every time he went to the ring was incredible to watch. It was fantastic to just let it play out before you. But as I've noted, it was incredibly punishing on the body. And unfortunately, when you punish your body, there can be a price to pay further down the line. And the case that I'm going to cover today is that that price, well, the payout was unimaginably costly. It's as simple as that. Benoit married his first wife, Martina. That was in 1988, and they went on to have two children together. That was David, he was born in 1993, and Megan, she was born in 1997. For whatever reason, that same year, the marriage ended, the couple got divorced. Benoit then went on to meet his second wife, and his second wife was Nancy. That's in the 1990s. And their wrestling stories essentially intertwine because she herself was in that world. So Nancy was a wrestling manager. She was also a model and she worked under the name Woman, which I love. I know that a lot of people have got glitzy names. I know that a lot of people put a lot of effort into making their name seem something that's in context with things like skeletons or the Crusher or, you know, hero things like She-Ra. I'd probably be something like She-Ra. I know that's probably not a wrestling name, but I do associate with She-Ra when I was a kid in the cartoons. And she looked quite hot and very muscly. But I like the idea that she called herself Woman. Because at a time where I think sometimes we underestimate women and what that means, I genuinely like the fact that she held that as her title, because it's powerful, it's strong, she's a creator, right? So that was Nancy. She was actually, when she met Benoit properly and their stories intertwined, married to his rival. This is a wrestler called Kevin Sullivan. As you'll know, in wrestling, often there are storylines that are created that help people get on side. And you engage in this world that isn't just in the ring. It plays out that there are heroes and villains and so on and so forth. So there is this storyline created and it's all about a feud. And the feud is between Benoit and Sullivan. So Benoit is meant to have had an affair with Sullivan's wife. So accordingly, to make this seem more real, it's necessary for Benoit and Nancy to go out and hold hands in public. They'd share hotel rooms. But as is the case occasionally, fantasy becomes reality. So Nancy and Benoit end up having a real affair. And Nancy ultimately leaves Sullivan for Benoit. And clearly they start a relationship together and it becomes something that is accepted. They become a real couple. On the 25th of February 2000, they have a child, Daniel Christopher Benoit. That's Chris's third child and second son. 8 months after that, Benoit and Nancy get married. It was Nancy's third marriage and it was Benoit's second. In 2003, this is after 3 years of Nancy and Benoit being married, she actually files for divorce. And the reason that she filed for that divorce was on the grounds that the marriage was irrevocably broken. She said that it was because of cruel treatment, that he threatened to hit her, and that he had thrown furniture, he'd smashed furniture, and she actually also requested a restraining order against him. So at that moment in time, she obviously was very unsatisfied in the relationship. Certainly from the suggestions that she put forward, she was also living in a scenario that wasn't necessarily safe, and she at this point wants to vacate it, so to speak. However, later down the line, she actually takes that back. So first of all, she actually drops the divorce proceedings, and then she drops the restraining order request. And to people who knew them, And certainly from the reports I've read and the interviews I've listened to, they say that the relationship had been fully patched up and that they had a very solid relationship. None of us will know how that relationship was. I think it's relatively unusual for people to try to cite in divorces reasons such as cruel behaviour and somebody throwing furniture around if there isn't an element of truth to that. That isn't me judging anybody, and I can't absolutely quantify that, but it is not unusual for people who are in love for a behaviour to play out in the relationship that you are not accepting of, then to act on that, such as saying that you want to get divorced or create a restraining position, and then the person works hard to win you back, and on top of that, makes you feel safe again. And at that point, you can change your behaviour and position. So I don't think it's fair to just say that she backtracked and there was absolutely no truth to it. Usually there is an element of truth to these things, but wasn't enough for her to actually abandon the relationship. And I'm sure that was because they had some really solid experiences together. Benoit had a best friend, and his best friend was fellow wrestler Eddie Guerrero. Now their friendship, and it was a really special friendship. It began when they were ironically in a match in Japan where Benoit actually accidentally knocked Guerrero unconscious, kicked him in the head, basically. I know what you're thinking. I agree. When have great friendships not been spawned by a good old kick in the head? But sarcasm aside, obviously they're in the same field, they're living the same kind of life. Irrespective of the fact that their relationship begins in such a way, it builds something really special. But what's again tragic, and there have been a lot of tragedies in wrestling, Guerrero died in 2005. He died from heart failure, and that was caused by an enlarged heart. So it was established that when they looked at the reasoning behind his death, it was likely linked to long-term steroid use. And if I'm honest, steroids have also been blamed in deaths of other wrestlers as well. So British Bulldog Davey Boy Smith, he died in 2002. And these kind of deaths promoted a need, as far as the regulation was concerned, to look at a new drug testing policy. Because when Guerrero died, it really provoked this understanding that these men and women were potentially putting themselves at risk for their sport and weren't aware of the ramifications and the problems that they might run into. WWE at this point, they also introduced its talent wellness program. That was in 2006. And the premise of this, from what I could draw out, is it aimed to look at the health of its wrestlers, and the whole emphasis was to enable them to make healthy lifestyle choices, but it also involved things like random drug testing. So it put that in the psyche of people who were involved in the sport with a knowledge that if they were found to test positive, that would be problematic for their career. So hoping that that fear of it may alleviate people's connection with those drugs that were causing deaths and causing major harms. As I noted before, for Benoit, he lost one of his closest allies. Guerrero's death was huge for him. It led to him really shutting himself off from his close friends. And I think that anybody who's been through a serious grief process, and I know that every single one of you will either have been through it, will be going through it, or you're waiting to go through it. That's what happens with grief. You know how isolating it can feel. It won't matter if there are 1,000 people affected. The point is, you are the individual going through it uniquely. And it can make you feel so alienated from everybody else. And when it's somebody who's part of your family, and that's the thing about really close friends, are the ones that we choose, aren't we? We have our family, often dysfunctional, and then we have our friends, totally functional, who we love and spend our time with. But the logistics of that mean when you lose that, it's powerfully displacing. It's really difficult to see your life in the same way. And we're talking about his relationship with Guerrero was actually a friendship and a professional relationship as well. So it's a double whammy when it comes to being cut off from the life source of that connection. The friends that knew him said he actually became like a hermit, and he was so transformed by Guerrero's death that he even considered quitting WWE. He decided that it might be better for him to set up a wrestling school. It was also noted that he had a real preoccupation with death. And at the time, whilst people thought it was strange, I wouldn't say that it rang the alarm bells at the level that hindsight would make us say those alarm bells should have been rung, because we all go through life with a bias about the people that we know and love. And certainly myself, having had a father who took his own life because of psychosis, I can tell you, you want to think positively about the people in your world, even when they seem to be acting in a way that is slightly out of character. It's very hard for you to go down that route of this person has got some really serious issues that could be life-threatening or dangerous to others, because you live with this feeling of hope. It's how we survive, isn't it? We always believe that things might be okay in the end. But nonetheless, these kind of preoccupations do start to cause people alarms, so to speak. And what Nancy would do is she would encourage him to actually write a diary. She wanted him to be cathartic in that experience, to allow himself to express how he felt. So he wrote in this diary that she got him a series of letters, and those letters were to his dead friend. She obviously felt that expressing those feelings could be helpful for him. And in therapy, certainly we suggest people should journal. We tell them to express the way that they're experiencing their lives, to deal with their most difficult, challenging emotions, to note it down for two reasons. One, there is definitely catharsis. Absolutely. The expression of taking words from your mind and placing them on paper is powerful. But secondly, it evidences healing. So when you start writing about something, it can be bleak, depressing, devastating, hopeless and helpless. And then as the year goes on, you can see glimmers and sparks of transition and change. Certainly my own experience of writing about the loss of my father, I can see a complete transition from when I really didn't want to be here to what it felt like to feel laughter and hope and happiness again. So it's really powerful when people write things. So she did this for an absolute opportunity to provide an outlet for his pain. Now his father stated, this is on reflection, so this is with that hindsight that we're talking about, when things play out and we're able to say, oh, okay, this disaster, this tragedy occurred. What, when we look back, are the contributory factors? It is very easy to say, well, that looks disturbed. But on a healing journey, there are lots of things that can seem really disturbing, and actually the person gets well and moves on. And this is normal. So hindsight is 20/20. And when they look back at those letters, it's clear that he was very depressed and that he was just absolutely racked with grief. And there are some disturbing things that he wrote, such as, I will be with you soon. So indicative of him potentially thinking about ending his own life. But he also does things like writes about his absolute love and admiration for his wife and his son. So it's not all darkness. And as noted, for any of you who've ever gone through a traumatic loss or a loss of somebody that you absolutely adore and miss, you do play with those ideas of just going to sleep and not waking up the next day. It's not because you're suicidal, it's just that you want to escape the pain. So again, it would not be unusual for people to express their absolutely darkest thoughts and feelings during a period of grief. During his career, Benoit also worked with several major promotions, and they were major. So these included Stampede Wrestling, Extreme Champion Wrestling, New Japan Pro Wrestling, World Championship Wrestling, and World Wrestling Entertainment. So he was big news. So at 5'10" and 220 pounds, he was a formidable opponent, genuinely. He really was a contender in the sport. In the early 1990s, he actually earned the nickname the Canadian Crippler. Instantly, You don't want to meet somebody with that name, do you? You don't want to meet somebody with a nickname, the Canadian Crippler, because the suggestion is he's definitely going to cripple you. Who wants to be crippled? And it takes me back to my Sundays at home, sat with my dad or my grandma watching this stuff, because it was just so much fun. Just so much fun to engage with these men and women who dressed so uniquely and where the drama was huge. I mean, you don't get that in sport, do you? You don't get true drama, but you do in wrestling. And he definitely played up to that. So he was called the Canadian Crippler when he was working with ECW. And that name was actually cemented in 1994. And the reason he was given that nickname was because he accidentally broke an opponent's neck seconds into a match. Yeah, he broke someone's neck. It was by mistake. It was actually a wrestler called Sabu, and he went on to make a full recovery, by the way. He didn't have any long-lasting permanent damage, but that is why he got that name, and it is an appropriate name. He just happened to break somebody's neck in the early stages of a competition. But again, that highlights one of the things that a lot of people underestimate about wrestling. It is an art form. It is a drama. It has storylines. It's also really dangerous. These guys and girls are massive professionals. They live and breathe this art drama sport. And when you hear about people having their neck broken or people dying in matches, it's because it is dangerous. And I think that sometimes that can be underestimated, this idea that it's all just showmanship and fun and it's not really a sport. It really is. It's a very dangerous sport. During Benoit's professional wrestling career, he actually held a total of 32 championships. That's huge. You know, it included winning the World Heavyweight Championship in 2004. And it was during this, when he was celebrating, he invited his wife and child into the ring to actually celebrate. Because I genuinely think, even though what I'm going to talk about is beyond tragic, horrific, and something that we would all wish had been avoided, I do think that Benoit at heart really did remain a family man. I think his family was incredibly important to him. Now, sports journalist Dave Meltzer, he described Benoit as one of the top 10, maybe even the top 5 all-time greats in pro wrestling history. And in 2017, former WWE rival Kurt Angle, he would say of Benoit, he has got to be in the top 3 of all time. So massively respected by those who knew him and also those who competed against him. But despite these accolades, the reality is that Benoit would and will never enter the WWE Hall of Fame. In fact, the story I'm going to tell you is why that's going to be quite the contrary, because instead of becoming a renowned, treasured wrestler who was recognised for all the work that he put in, instead he's going to get almost entirely wiped from the WWE's records. That includes being wiped from its website, future broadcasts, all publications. It's like he was completely erased from history. And the reason why is because in an act that would absolutely devastate and traumatize and shock the wrestling world, Benoit would actually be responsible for a double murder. And the victims, well, they were his own wife and his young child. That's what I'm going to talk about today. But I felt like before I started to do that, it was important for you to understand who this character was before these horrific crimes played out. So in 2007, Benoit's 40 years old. He's living in Fayetteville in Georgia. Beautiful home. Absolutely stunning home where he lives with his 43-year-old wife, Nancy, and their 7-year-old son, Daniel. The family from the outside certainly seemed to have it all. Genuinely, if you look up pictures of their place that they lived, it is just idyllic, safe, beautiful, lush, green, huge. Everything the American dream is about. And Benoit was doing really well. He was making more than $500,000 a year. and their home at the time was worth $900,000. It would be worth a lot more now. It was incredible. On the afternoon of the 22nd of June 2007, it was a Friday, Benoit actually met with his doctor, Dr. Phil Astin. Now, according to Astin, he said that Benoit didn't show any signs of distress. He wasn't rageful. He wasn't expressing anything concerning. Certainly, he didn't stand out in that consultation as having any kind of issues. On the night of Friday, the 22nd of June 2007, in spite of people obviously having seen him in apparently an all right state, Benoit killed his wife. He bound her feet, he bound her wrists, that was in the bedroom, and she died of asphyxiation. Basically, the way that Benoit killed her was he pressed a knee into her back and he was pulling on a cord around her neck. Bear in mind, he was a very strong man. It wouldn't be very difficult for him to overpower pretty much anybody. It's what he did in the ring, and he could certainly do that with a woman. He then placed a Bible near her body. Then on the morning of the 23rd of June 2007, Benoit actually sedated his son Daniel, who was seven, and he killed him. He asphyxiated him as well. He also did that same thing. He placed a Bible near his body. Personally, when I think about the fact that he placed Bibles near their bodies, that type of behaviour would, in my opinion, fit contextually with somebody who was maybe dealing with some kind of psychosis. It's not usual behaviour. Aside from the fact, obviously, murdering your family is completely atypical behaviour, what I'm getting across is that that says to me there is more going on than just murdering his wife and child. The Bible, for me, represents a belief system that he was experiencing in his head. I can't quantify it. I can't clarify it further than that. It's just a suspicion, but nonetheless, it is a suspicion of my lived experience with psychosis. That is not what you would expect to see. Might be completely wrong. Just putting it out there. Now, during that weekend, what we know is that Benoit also went online and made some really chilling searches. These included a search for the story about the prophet Elijah from the Bible. Now, this was specifically about the resurrection of a young boy from the Old Testament. Again, that's concerning. That doesn't sound like somebody who's in their right mind. And certainly when he's killed his child, what is his mindset telling him? What is he living in that moment? Is this a break from reality completely? Later that day, this is around 3:30 p.m., fellow wrestler and really close friend, Chavo Guerrero, receives a voicemail. And that voicemail message is from Benoit. Now, Chavo was actually the nephew of Benoit's best friend, Eddie Guerrero. And Benoit had grown really close to Chavo after Eddie's death, obviously having that relationship and feeling that there is a familiarity and being able to talk about somebody that you've lost is really powerful and helpful during the grief process. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that he became very close to Chavo. In the message, Benoit states that Nancy and Daniel had serious food poisoning, and that meant that he'd be late for that night's house show in Beaumont, which was in Texas. So when Chavo calls him back, he felt immediately concerned. He said that Benoit sounded very tired, he sounded very groggy, and then when he tried to call him back again, he didn't actually answer. Now, when Benoit called back later on, he apologised. He said, really sorry about that. It's just that we're stressed, you know, my family is ill, but I'm okay. And Chavo says, well, you know what, I'm here. If you want to talk about that, if you need somebody to listen to you. Then Benoit ends the call saying, Chavo, I love you. And he said that I love you with emphasis. And when Chavo has talked about this and he's been interviewed about this, he said it really stuck with him. The call seemed weird, but he also remembered that kind of outstanding I love you, almost as if it was a different kind of message, a message that he was letting him know, listen to this, I love you. And I think that those goodbyes that we don't know are happening often involve that. where somebody is letting us know that they're not going to be present anymore, but they want us to know of our infinite meaning to them. But in that moment, we're not aware because we're just going through the normal motions. And it sounds like that could have been the case here. Another co-worker actually speaks to Benoit the same day. And again, Benoit says the same story. His family have food poisoning and actually says that they're vomiting blood, which obviously would sound very, very serious. And ultimately, Benoit doesn't turn up for the show that night. He leaves a voicemail on Chabot's phone and he says he'd be in Texas the following morning. So it seems like he's trying to put off people expecting him to be present, give himself a little bit of distance. WWE executives, they then rebook Benoit's flight for the following morning and they arrange for Benoit to fight in a pay-per-view event in Houston the following evening. And he was actually booked to win the title in one of the three world championship matches at the Vengeance Night of Champions event. However, in spite of the fact that he was lined up for that, it was a title that he'd never get to claim. When WWE attempted to confirm his travel plans, obviously because they needed to get him to the competition, they were unable to actually get in contact with him. On the early hours of Sunday the 24th of June, that's 2007, Benoit then sends several text messages from both his and Nancy's mobile phones to his co-workers. This is at 3:51 a.m. and 3:58 a.m. And in four of them, he just gave his home address. He said, "My physical address is 130 Green Meadow Lane." On a fifth, it stated, "The dogs are in the enclosed pool area, garage side door open." Now, on reflection, what the investigators think is that he wanted to alert people to the fact that somebody needed to go to the house so that the bodies could be discovered as soon as possible. Now, one of those texts was sent to Chavo. He awoke. He did read it, but he didn't reply because as far as he was concerned, he was meant to be picking up Benoit from the airport later that morning. So he talked to him then. Sadly, he never was on that plane. So he didn't arrive on the 8 a.m. flight. And later that morning, Benoit called WWE. And at this point, he advised them that he and his wife were in hospital with Daniel, who was really, really unwell with this food poisoning. Again, he states he'd fly to Texas later that day. Now, at this point, he's still due to fight CM Punk for the vacant ECW World Championship. But he didn't turn up. And bear in mind, this is a man who took wrestling so seriously. It was his life's blood. His dedication was second to none. This is completely out of character with this man. So it seems that in this interim between him ringing and letting them know that he'd be there later, it's then that he kills himself. And he did that in his basement in the weights room. And it was later established that over the weekend, Benoit had been researching online the quickest and the easiest way to break a neck. Which just is a horrible thing to imagine somebody sitting there doing, isn't it? Just a horrible idea that this person who's been known as a hero for such a long time is a good friend to so many people, has been known as a really great family man, is sitting trawling online about the quickest way to break his own neck after murdering his family. Really is tragic. And what he did was he used his lat pull-down machine to actually hang himself. So he used a towel around his neck, he attached it to the handle of the machine, and then he pulled the handle down using a really heavy weight, and then he let it go, and he actually broke his neck instantly. But I can't imagine what it would be like in that moment. Most of you who come to my channel know I have personal experience of this, and I still can't quite conceive the person making that final movement and doing something that would snuff out their existence. But nonetheless, this is the frame of mind that he's in. So after he fails to show up for his match, friends obviously become really concerned. They've received these unusual text messages. So WWE ask authorities to carry out a welfare check on Benoit and his family. So on the afternoon of Monday, the 25th of June, 2007, police go there. And I've watched the police officer talk about this. And as far as he was concerned, it was just going to be somebody knocking on the door, checking out that everybody's okay, and then leaving. There was absolutely no suspicion whatsoever that he might be attending a murder-suicide. No warning signs, no expectations, no massive prior list to suggest there was lots of domestic abuse and problems at that address. So the police officer goes to the property and actually speaks with a neighbour. And one of the things that he gets from that neighbour is to understand that she can manage the dogs, because as Benoit has texted, the dogs are actually out. So the police officer says, do you know how to handle them? And she's like, I look after these dogs regularly. I'll go over and I'll make sure that the dogs are okay and get into the house. So because she knows how to handle the dogs, she then takes them into the house. And then moments later, she runs from the house screaming, Daniel's dead. So this, as I've said, completely out of the blue. She isn't going in there with trepidation. She isn't thinking something dreadful has occurred. There is no expectation in her mind whatsoever. The fact that she runs from that house saying, Daniel's dead. The fact that she enters that house without fear says this was not something that she would ever have been able to conceive in her experience of the family per se. So when the police enter the Benoit family home, one of the things they notice straight away is decomposing smell. They can smell that decomposing bodies. Anybody who works in pathology or forensics will tell you that bodies have an odour that is never forgotten. When they are decomposing, you will recognise it for the rest of your life. Now, when they looked at the decomposition of each of the bodies, they could tell, when they reflected on this, that the deaths had been staggered. At this point, the house is obviously declared a major crime scene. And they find Nancy wrapped in a towel in the bedroom. There was blood under her head. This indicated that she probably put up a struggle. Also, hydrocodone, which is the opioid which is used to treat pain, and alprazolam, which is actually Xanax, for those of you who know it by that title. That's a fast-acting tranquilizer. They found therapeutic levels in her body, but it was difficult to establish pre-death levels because of the decomposition, so she could have had much higher levels in her body. Daniel's body was found in his bed. He's only 7 years of age, and his face was down on the pillow. Also, he had internal injuries to the throat area, and they believe, this is what they suspect, that his father may have used a chokehold to kill him. There was also a knife lying under the bed, although it hadn't been used. It's really heartbreaking because when they saw the scene of Daniel's death, there were wrestling action figures and a toy championship belt that were found in his room, because obviously his father was his hero. And it really pulls on my heartstrings, because I had the kids' wrestling belts when my boys were growing up, and I had the wrestling figures, and it brings back genuinely lovely memories of childhood. And clearly for Daniel, this was even bigger, because his dad, his hero, his role model, was indeed a championship wrestler. But that was the scene that they found. An autopsy was also able to find that Daniel had been sedated with Xanax, and the likelihood is, thank God, he was unconscious when he was murdered. Benoit, of course, well, they found his body hanging from the pulley of his exercise machine. Again, they found therapeutic levels of Xanax and hydrocodone in his system. They also found elevated levels of testosterone cypionate, which is a synthetic anabolic steroid. So they found that in his system, and it was suspected that Benoit was possibly being treated for a deficiency caused by previous steroid abuse. This can actually result in testicular insufficiency. Benoit's personal doctor, Phil C. Astin III, he actually got investigated, and he later got sentenced to 10 years in prison for illegally prescribing drugs. And he also sometimes prescribed medication without even first examining the patients. Hello. I require some medication. What kind of medication? Some very, very strong sedatives. What's wrong with you? I can't sleep and I have a back problem. I can't see you today. Are you sure? Yes, it's very, very bad. I can't sleep and I'm in pain. I'll send you some very high-level opiates and some sedatives. Thank you. That should never happen, ever, but it did. And the problem there is, you trust a doctor. If a doctor's bent and is giving you medication, likelihood is you're going to minimise it because there's a permission base there, because they're qualified. Don't get me started on the fact that some of the biggest body counts, serial killer-wise, were doctors. That'll make you stay safe at night, won't it? That'll make you feel better when you need somebody in your vulnerable hour. Anyway, initially, one of the things that they thought about this crime was there was no suicide note left by Benoit, which is what you would expect. You'd expect to find, particularly when there's been a staggered level of deaths, that somebody would at least let people know that they were choosing to leave this world. However, they did actually manage to find a handwritten notation, which was in the Bible belonging to Benoit. And it just said, "I am preparing to leave this earth." Again, when you hear those kind of notes, "I am preparing to leave this earth," the fact that there is premeditation to his suicide, the fact that there are Bibles around, the fact that he is speaking in this strange way, "I am preparing to leave this earth," that doesn't sound like suicide. It sounds like the idea of ascension, because you don't prepare to leave this earth. You kill yourself. You say, "I am taking my own life," or "you're better off without me, but I am preparing to leave this earth," sounds, as I said, a little less typical when we think about suicide notes that we find, in my experience. Anyway, another thing that the autopsy found, which again is so tragic, is that if Benoit hadn't gone ahead and killed himself, he probably would have only been alive for another 10 months. The years of steroid abuse had caused his heart to grow 3 times its normal size. So it was literally a ticking time bomb, which is terrifying. It is really strange and really disturbing that Benoit chose to kill his family and then stay in the house for a full day before he killed himself. That really makes you feel that there was something untoward going on with him mentally. And of course, look, when we're talking about familicide and the fact that somebody has literally annihilated their family, clearly they are disturbed. Clearly there is something going on. But often in these circumstances, it's to do with domination, bullying, wanting to have what other people fear may get, i.e. losing your family and then moving on somewhere else, punishing a partner and all of these things. But the way he's acting seems a little less in context with that and more, in my opinion, mentally unwell, in serious mental decline. Again, this is just me making those assumptions based on my experiences, but it certainly feels like that's more in context. And I'm not lending any excuses here. What happened was unforgivable and tragic and devastating and debilitating to all of those members of families left behind. However, I don't think it's fair not to note that there is something strange about the way that this played out. Now, the following night, this is before the full facts of the killings were released, WWE cancelled all the scheduled matches and they aired a really special tribute episode to Benoit. So wrestlers who knew him, they all spoke about him, and they also spoke about him as who they were, so their regular selves. They weren't wearing costumes, they didn't have stage names. It was very much a reality check. You know, this is who I am as a human being, talking about who I've lost as a human being. However, once the details of Benoit's actions get released, well, WWE soon, understandably with respect, backtrack. And at this point, they literally made the decision to remove nearly all mentions of Benoit from their records. It's like he never existed. You can't even begin to conceive how the family members are coping with all of this. I mean, Benoit's family were just grief-stricken and utterly stunned and perplexed by the killings, because this behaviour was said to be completely out of character. His father, Michael, he described Benoit as a kind and gentle man. His first wife, first wife. So if anyone's going to have some gripes, it's the first wife, isn't it? If I'm going to have an opportunity to take a pop at somebody, it'll be the first wife or first husband in these circumstances. And his first wife, Martina, said he was the most loving person anyone could imagine. He even volunteered with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. He used to go and visit US troops overseas in Iraq. And during his wrestling experience and career, he managed to cultivate an image which was very wholesome, a very family-orientated man. He was once actually asked, "What's your biggest advice?" And he replied, "Quality time with my family, it's a big advice. It's something I'll fight for and crave." So historically, he's seen as a very warm and generous and loving human being. And that's why it's so utterly devastating and shocking for those who know him that this has played out. Investigators then try to establish a motive, which makes perfect sense. It is highly unusual for somebody to kill their entire family, particularly when there doesn't seem to have been that many red flags before. So at the crime scene, the police managed to find prescriptions for anabolic steroids. Now, anabolic steroids, which are bodybuilding drugs, can cause, as side effects, paranoia, depression, and explosive outbursts. So police initially suspect that roid rage may have accounted for Benoit's actions. Roid rage was a big thing in the 90s. Big thing in the 90s. There was a lot about roid rage. No, it was something that was considered to be a problem. Although I appreciate there will be a lot of people who take steroids and feel that they do it safely. And in the States in particular, I read about a lot of people doing that. But in the UK, that was very much seen as a big problem in the bodybuilding world because it had these ramifications that could impact on the individual health-wise and also on the people around that individual. So I suppose what they were looking at there was this idea that maybe years of steroid abuse had just caused him to become unhinged. Even though that term road rage was big in the 90s, it actually began being used in the mid-1980s. And the reason that it started being used was there were some pretty violent crimes committed by bodybuilders. So studies, the research that's taken place, have shown that there's a clear connection between testosterone and aggression. However, research suggests the phenomenon of steroid-induced rages is actually debatable. So even though there's been a lot of links, it does seem to be relatively debatable because a lot of people take steroids and very few of them do any harm to other people. So again, the link isn't necessarily as big as, shall we say, the press suggested it was. So authorities soon established that Benoit did receive drug deliveries from an online business, which was Signature Pharmacy. They sold steroids, human growth hormone, testosterone, and it also at this point turned out that this particular pharmacy were just basically supplying steroids to a huge number of sports stars. That included lots of WWE wrestlers, also MedXLife.com, another online business. They were investigated and six people, that's including two of the pharmacy's owners, they ended up pleading guilty to offences linked to illegal steroid sales. And 20 more were arrested, including doctors and pharmacists. One could say it was a racket. It was a racket. Money-making opportunity that these companies used to exploit people who came from an area where they felt that these individuals, as they were pharmacists, could be trusted sources. And even though they would have known they were being a little bit naughty, you wouldn't feel it because, hey, if a doctor or a pharmacist is prescribing it you, why would you worry? I mean, I've got a list, but that's not for this video today, is it? So WWE issued a statement shortly after the deaths, and they stated steroids were not and could not be related to the cause of death. Because what they did was they referred to the physical evidence at the crime scenes. So the gap between the killings, the method of the killings, the presence of the Bibles, all of that indicated that this was deliberate. It wasn't rage. It didn't happen in the heat of the moment. And also, it was worth knowing that Benoit had actually tested negative for steroids in April. So that didn't make sense. You can understand that people wanted to fit it that way. It's just easier, isn't it? Oh, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't happen unless the person is doing A, B, or C. It kind of makes people feel more comfortable, doesn't it? That it couldn't happen to them, but it isn't real. You know, he had taken time over this situation. That does not fit that he was incandescent with rage and unable to control himself. Then there was another theory, and that was of domestic problems, exacerbated apparently by Daniel suffering from Fragile X syndrome. Now that's a genetic condition, and typically it manifests itself in low IQ, associated learning difficulties, and also some certain physical characteristics, so like a long, narrow face, quite a prominent jawbone, and ears that are quite prominent too. And it can also cause a range of issues with language, emotions, attention, behaviour, social integration, all things that obviously would concern parents. And when they examined Daniel's body, they did find needle marks in his arm. Authorities actually think that the reason that he had those needle marks was because he'd been given growth hormones for some time, and that was because the family considered that he was quite small. So another theory was that Benoit was actually having an affair with another female wrestler, and that he'd argued with Nancy about a life insurance policy. Seems like a bit of a flimsy connection, doesn't it? Well, I'm having an affair, which should make you probably feel pretty good and sexy and vital, because that tends to be why people have affairs. Well, that would be, yeah, how most people feel, but we argued about life insurance policy. And that was something that was enough to make you murder your family. Yeah, it doesn't add up for me either. But anyway, okay, that was another theory, this idea that there was an insurance policy issue and he was having an affair, and that was what caused him to lose his mind and murder his family. However, in spite of the fact that this theory was kind of tossed around, many of the people who knew the couple really didn't agree with it. They felt that there weren't actually marital problems that were significant. And that includes Benoit's driver, who stated this: they always seemed like they were the happiest people. Now, I appreciate that none of us know what goes on behind closed doors, but historically, Benoit's behavior certainly didn't seem violent. His family members, his ex-wife, have all validated this. And even though, of course, a domestic abuser will often be quite nice in public, and then once the door is closed, they will be horrific, heinous human beings. But I feel that the driver, seeing them regularly and reflecting that even when they could have been quiet or being a little bit off with each other, that he didn't pick up on any of that, demonstrates that even if they did have some problems, they weren't that huge. It also turns out that Daniel didn't even suffer from Fragile X syndrome. Again, another thing that got disputed is that Daniel didn't actually have any marks on his arm anyway. So some of the stuff that got out wasn't necessarily represented in fact. Following the double murder suicide, Benoit's family were absolutely desperate for answers. So were his friends. This wasn't just a couple of people who couldn't deal with the fact that their relation had become a murderous person who had destroyed people's lives, including children. They just couldn't connect it. It just didn't seem to be an explanation for his actions. All of the suggestions that had been made didn't connect and fit. So at this point, a guy called Christopher Nowinski gets in touch with Benoit's father. Now, Nowinski is a neuroscientist and an author, also co-founder and CEO of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, which is an organization that helps athletes, veterans, and actually anyone else who's been affected by concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is something that's a massive cause close to Nowinski's heart, because he was also a former wrestler. And the reason that he retired was due to concussion issues. Now, Nowinski had actually once noted that Benoit was one of the only guys who could take a chair shot to the back of the head, which is stupid, is what he said. That wasn't me. That's what he said. He said it was stupid that allowing yourself to be hit over the head that way by a chair is not going to do your head very much good. Like I said at the beginning, our brain is very, very important. And as much as there is a skull covering it, believe me, it can be fractured. And even if it isn't fractured, being hit on the head can cause enormous problems, front or back. So then Nowinski decides that he's going to contact Benoit's father, Michael. And what he says is, listen, it's possible that years of trauma to Benoit's brain may have been the precursor for his actions. So as early as the 1920s, boxers were actually diagnosed with a condition called punch drunk syndrome. And if you've ever seen somebody punched really hard, that they look confused and concussed and like staggering around, they do look drunk. So you can understand where that phrase comes from. But this condition is now a lot better understood, and it's referred to as chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Or for my benefit, because I find that quite a mouthful to get out to you, it's known as CTE. I appreciate that. I appreciate it, the shortened term. So this is a neurodegenerative disease, and it's linked to repeated blows to the head. And the symptoms that they see in this condition are things like behavioral problems, mood problems, cognitive impairments, or problems with thinking. Sufferers may be prone to lots of inappropriate or explosive behavior. They might also display what's considered pathological jealousy or paranoia. And rates of CTE have been found to be about 30% among those who have had a history of multiple head injuries. Now, what's really sad about this is that the diagnosis of CTE cannot be made in living individuals, because the diagnosis, for clarity, can only really be given when there's an autopsy, which is awful. Because if people are walking around with such a debilitating condition and people are blaming the way that they are acting on their choice, it's not fair, and it's also not reality. So Benoit's dad obviously agrees for a section of his son's brain to be tested, and it's tested by a doctor called Dr. Julian Bales. And Dr. Julian Bales is actually a founding member of the Brain Injury Research Institute, and he's also the professor and chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at West Virginia University School of Medicine. So a real expert in their field. So Bales and his research team, they'd actually previously investigated cases that fitted this. They'd analysed the brains of former NFL players, including Andre Waters and Terry Long. Both of those had died by suicide. So Bales' team had actually noticed that there was a familiar pattern in individuals who were involved in high impact and contact sports. So boxing, mixed martial arts, American football, ice hockey, and so on and so forth. And the pattern included failure in the personal lives, the business lives, depression, and then ultimately suicide. And when you consider that this is such a terrifying pattern, you know, we're talking about sportsmen at the top of their game and sportswomen at the top of their game being placed in these incredibly precarious physical situations that ultimately could see them take their own lives. So Bales then compares microscopic scans from Benoit's brain to those of a healthy brain to see whether the brain had been impacted. According to Bale's results, they showed that Benoit's brain was so severely damaged, it resembled the brain of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient. That's right. Double his age and the equivalent of somebody who was in serious decline because of Alzheimer's. Now, like the retired NFL players, scans indicated that Benoit had an advanced form of dementia. They found damage in every section of the brain, all four lobes and deep into the brainstem. And also what they found is when they scanned it, they found brown clumps or tangles, as they're noted. And that is an area of dead brain cells. And those brain cells had been killed off because of head trauma. So Bale stated this: it was extensive throughout Chris's brain. This is something you should never see in a 40-year-old. So like the NFL players, Benoit had suffered multiple concussions, he'd sank into a depression, and then he'd harmed himself or others, in this case, his family. So that shows the pattern. In retrospect, when you think about it, well, the results shouldn't be surprising, should they? Benoit had actually previously told friends that he had suffered more concussions than he could count. So this was just par for the course in his life, but the ramifications and the impact of those concussions played out potentially in his behaviour. So following the findings, Benoit's father reflected on the diagnosis and his son's actions, and he said this: "This wasn't him. He would never do that. I think something went terribly wrong. The doctor said he had CTE. He had CTE. So I don't think that was him." I appreciate when we're saying this that we're also talking about the murder of an innocent child and an innocent woman. This does not forgive what happened. There is no forgiving the fact that Benoit did what he did. It was tragic, catastrophic, diabolical, despicable. It's all those things, and I appreciate that. Because at the end of the day, there should be a woman and now a young man walking around, living their lives, and Benoit essentially should have been the one to make a choice about his own life, and that isn't how it's played out. It's awful. I'm not minimizing it, but we have to understand a chain of causation. By understanding a chain of causation, we can potentially change outcomes for other people. So he's definitely guilty of murder, but I also think to some degree that he is a victim of circumstance, of his physiology, of his injury. That is certainly something, in my opinion, that is playing into these outcomes. Now, in the following decade, after this happened and he murdered his wife and child, the post-mortem brain research on several other deceased wrestlers also diagnosed findings consistent with CTE. That included Axel Rotten, Balls Mahoney, Jimmy Snuka, Mr. Fuji, and Ron Biss. So WWE actually got heavily criticised following this tragedy. And the reason for that is they kind of just totally backed off. You know, they weren't there for Benoit's remaining family. And bear in mind, this was a guy who had made them a huge amount of money. He was somebody that had promoted wrestling. He was somebody that had been much loved in wrestling. And when he died, there were impacts on people who loved him. And WWE, who were meant to go and look out after the mental welfare of wrestlers, surely should have extended some care and consideration to Benoit's remaining family. But also, as opposed to them not just even extending some kind of care and compassion for the remaining family, they just tried to erase Benoit completely from history. Let's just eradicate him. We don't like what he did. What should we do about that? I mean, in history, there's a lot of people who've done things that we wish they hadn't done, but we haven't completely erased them. But this is the modern era. We can erase people fully. We'll just pretend they never existed. But he did. He did exist. And for his family, not only was he erased from their lives because he died, he was erased from everything that had meaning to him, and that would have been incredibly painful. They also came under massive criticism for the wellness policy that was in place at the time. And actually, Nancy, when she was alive, she'd even criticized that policy. She described it as a joke. She said, for example, there were major failures due to loopholes in the drug testing policy. And let's be honest, guys, she was clearly absolutely 100% right. Benoit obviously had two other kids, and his first son, David, well, he's now hoping to follow in his father's footsteps. He wants to be a wrestler. He's even stated that he'd like to adopt his dad's name. He wants his ring gear. He wants his entrance music. Chris Jericho as well, friend of Benoit and fellow former WWE star, he said, "Look, I believe in David. I believe that he can be a star," and he's taken him under his wing. And again, it's quite an emotional thing, that, isn't it? That even though, to some degree, WWE rejected and abandoned Benoit and his family, Benoit's friends didn't. There's something about their history with him, the knowledge of him, that in spite of this brutality, despite this abandonment of his humanness in those last moments when he murdered that poor woman and that poor child. His friends are able to hold on to the humanity that he used to bear. And the fact that they're now trying to protect and bring up his child to give him the same opportunities that his father had at some point in his life is really emotional, isn't it? And Chris Jericho actually says this: if it's really that guy's dream and he's really giving it his all, I don't see why he should be stopped. He cannot be held responsible for his father's sins. And again, it's very possible for people to be able to acknowledge the horror of what Benoit did. And it is. It's horrific. There's no excuse. Absolutely unforgivable. We all agree with that. But it seems like Benoit's friends, peers, family are able to disassociate the end from the entirety of that human's life. And I suppose that the CTE gives them a real leverage for that, that this man was in serious decline. He didn't know, Nancy didn't know, his friends didn't know. And it's also warning bells to other people out there to think that, you know, if you are in a position where you're getting concussed regularly, this is something that you really need to consider, because these kind of outcomes, though rare, are possible. Now, in spite of the fact that I've covered all possible bases as to how we arrived at those poor, innocent people being murdered, the truth is we're never going to exactly know why Chris Benoit did what he did. I mean, I'll be honest with you, the major factor for me is that most likely it was brain damage that he'd suffered. This wasn't only from repeated concussions, but it's also from years of steroid abuse, because studies have shown that long-term use of anabolic steroids is actually linked to significant brain structural and functional abnormalities. And when you think about wrestling, and this is no criticism to the wrestling world, because everything grows and progresses and learns, and it's important to look at the negatives so that protective mechanisms can be put in place. But when you explore the world of wrestling, it does seem to be the perfect storm for brain injury, because repeated concussions are par for the course. Furthermore, to some degree, the audience mostly expects to see really muscle-bound wrestlers. And to achieve that kind of physique, to go that far in sport, well, anabolic steroids seem to be a necessity rather than a choice to some degree. Steroids damage the heart, and obviously the sheer size of those bodies that the wrestlers have, well, that adds extra strain to the heart. And also, wrestlers don't get a rest. So unlike most sports, there's actually not an off season. They perform throughout the entire year, sometimes as often as 6 times per week. That means that they might be on the road for 300 days a year. And anybody who goes on tour, anybody who's away from home, you know, it's rare that you eat as well. It's rare that you sleep as well. So you can add that kind of stress onto the scenario as well. And injuries, well, they cost wrestlers money. So often, they just need to struggle through the adversity, so to speak, which means that they don't often heal how they should. And that means that a lot of them end up relying on painkillers. And we all know how pharmaceutical companies like you to get a bit addicted, or a lot addicted, to their drugs. And there's a lot of opioids that is available on prescription that will get you hooked and ruin your life. But you know what? It's prescribed by somebody who's meant to care about you, so you believe it will be fine. And for wrestlers, they're taking that because they have to work through it. And also because they have to actually counter the sedative effect that those painkillers have on them while they take uppers, drugs that make them more alert. So this is a vicious cycle. Their bodies are getting punished constantly. And finally, you know, a lot of them are considered celebrities. So celebrity lifestyle comes with a whole heap of issues that if you don't regulate can be a huge problem in your life. So lots of alcohol, recreational drugs, again, they are aggravating features. And even though I think it's cleaning up a lot these days, past decades, it was absolutely prevalent. So all of those factors that I've just described in one person's body, from the overwork, the unhealed injuries, the repeated concussions, the dependency on drugs to just get you through the day, the work schedule that most of us could not bear, and always having to perform, that is going to be difficult to maintain. And you won't be surprised when I tell you that mortality rates in the wrestling world are utterly shocking. So whilst the big names may appear prime specimens of athletic prowess, internally, it's the opposite. Often, I mean that. So they look great, they look amazing, but what's going on internally for them is at a complete juxtaposition. So the research by the University of Eastern Michigan, well, it very much supports this contention. The academics studied a group of 557 former wrestlers between 1985 and 2011. 62 died. That's 49 of these died before the age of 50. 24 of them died before the age of 40. Two of them died before the age of 30. Mortality rates for wrestlers aged between 45 and 54 were 2.9 times greater than the average rate for men in the US. And the most common cause of death? Heart disease. These fit, healthy looking guys and girls, and yet inside, it's decaying. Now, whilst the outcome of wrestling matches may be staged, it doesn't take away the skill, it doesn't take away the strength, it doesn't take the huge athleticism that's required of the wrestlers away. You know, these people are athletes, and it's a demand that puts this huge pressure on their bodies. It takes an incredible toll, and the on-screen personas, the costumes, they almost make those wrestlers look like superheroes, like they're superhuman, but they're not. It doesn't matter how big and bold and strong and confident and athletic they seem, they're human. They're as fragile as anyone else. No wrestling, wow. It remains an entertaining spectacle for millions, but the human cost shouldn't be forgotten. And I think that the case that I've covered today hopefully examples that. Like I've said, I'm not trying to come down easy on a man who murdered his son and his wife. It's reprehensible behaviour. It's tragic beyond measure. But if we are to figure out how these kind of horrific tragedies cannot continue to play out, it's by understanding what could potentially have been the things that contributed to the outcome. And as I said, when we look at Benoit, undoubtedly, there are some serious warning signs that were potentially missed. There is some serious safeguarding that should have occurred within the industry to prevent him from ending up in such a situation. And most importantly, it tells a story of needing to do more to protect these incredible human beings who entertain so many millions of us in our homes every single year. This is obviously for Nancy and for Daniel. Their lives were cut short in the most heinous of ways by somebody that they no doubt were devoted to. And I think that their families will always have a gaping wound in their lives because of their absence. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.